Tonight's lesson is from Colossians chapter 3, where Paul makes the point very clearly that we need to look to or dwell on things above. So, if you will, let's turn in our Bibles to Colossians 3. I know it's a lengthier reading as we look at 17 verses set before us. And even somewhat recently, in the last few months, we did a study of this. We're going to go through, I think, the thoughts are good for us to dwell on for a few minutes tonight, Colossians 3. When he starts off in chapter 3, verse 1, saying, if then you've been raised with Christ has to do with being baptized. So back in chapter 2, verse 12 specifically, Paul there says that we have been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God who raised him from the dead. In that one verse, Colossians 2:12, we have pretty much everything we need. It's not just the idea of baptism, but faith, and notice, in the powerful working of God. So it's not, as some would suggest, that baptism is a work of man and that faith somehow is a superior thing. They are equal. And in this one verse, we have everything kind of tied together. Again, having been buried with him in baptism, in which also you were raised with him through faith, by means of faith, in the powerful working of God who raised him from the dead. So 3:1, if then you've been raised with Christ, then keep seeking the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you've died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. So what are we to do? What is the practical part of this? Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you. And the idea of put to death kind of sounds, I don't know, it's not as direct. Maybe the old King James uses mortify, therefore. The idea is to actively kill. Every time I read chapter 3 and verse 5 here in Colossians, I think of what Samuel the prophet did to King Agag. You remember Saul back in 1 Samuel doesn't do what he had been commanded by God in obliterating the Amalekites. So instead, he offers King Agag the best of everything, and Samuel takes his own sword and hacks Agag into pieces. It's not this idea that Samuel just stabs him once and kills him. It's not a stab to the heart, or even, you know, chopping his head off. It is a hacking to pieces. It's an extremely violent sort of thing. I always imagine, kind of in our modern way of telling stories, an Obi-Wan Kenobi sort of person that's just with a lightsaber whirling around and all, and just going at him. And there's no other way to look at it in 1 Samuel. That when Samuel does this to King Agag, it's no other way to look at the text and come up with a nicer conclusion. He hacks him into pieces, and he does so to obliterate this Agag, but also to show Saul the violence of God, the wrath of God. If you will, imagine blood everywhere. That's kind of the idea of hacking Agag to pieces. So Paul says, put to death what is earthly in you: sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. On account of these, the wrath of God is coming. In these you too once walked when you were living in them, but now you must put them all away: anger, wrath, malice, slander, and obscene talk from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, seeing that you put off the old self with its practices, and you put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. Here there is not Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free, but Christ is all and in all. Put on then. So it's the act of killing, but then put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. And above all these, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body, and be thankful. I've always found it a little interesting. Ironic maybe is the word that I'm looking for. When he speaks of the word, or rather the peace of Christ ruling in your hearts there in verse 15, we think of peace as not something that rules, but that's exactly the idea. For there to be peace, there has to be rule. And here, the peace of Christ must rule in our hearts. And that's what we've been called. In one body, being thankful. And then finally, verse 16, 17, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God. And whatever you do, in word or deed, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through Him. Now that's, I know, a lengthy reading, and I've inserted a few things there, but that's, in my mind, the essence of what he means when he says, if you've been raised, then keep seeking. And you notice the development of, if you will, progress. If you're going to set your minds on things that are above, not on things here on earth, that means we're putting to death what's earthly in us. Again, verse 5. And that also means that we're putting on, as God's chosen ones, as God's elect, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, and so on. So it's not just the putting off, it's the putting on. Paul, in a parallel passage in Ephesians 4:22, says we're to put off, be renewed in the spirit of our minds, and put on. So it's an act in Ephesians 4:22 through 24 is three things. Put off, be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and put on. Here he just says put off or kill these parts of you that are earthly and then put on as you should, being God's chosen ones, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience. All of these characteristics, of course, that we see in Jesus. Speaking of the mind that we are to have, look over in Matthew 16. I think this is interesting here. In Matthew 16, we're probably most familiar with the whole thing going on before this context in verse 21 through 23. So in Matthew 16, we read together as Jesus asks them, beginning in verse 13, that he comes into the region of this Caesarea Philippi. Now, I know it's been quite a while since we talked about this, but Caesarea Philippi was an area where they had this cave, a very deep cave. Some have estimated it being, you know, so deep, like it's miles deep. But they had built all around this cave idols. Even among the Jews here, there were idols. And it's here that Jesus asks. I don't think it's accidental. I don't think Matthew says, oh, by the way, we just happened to be in this town that was just full of idolatry. I think the point is, they're in this district. Anybody who knew Caesarea Philippi would know this. And so he asks his disciples, who do people say that I am, the Son of Man? And so they said, some are saying you're John the Baptist, some are saying Elijah, others are saying you're Jeremiah, or maybe one of the prophets. And he said, who do you say that I am? And this is where Peter makes, really, you know, it's not just an observation, this is something that was revealed to him divinely. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, Simon son of John, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who's in heaven. And I tell you, you're Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell or the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I'm going to stop here for just a moment to suggest that when he says you're Peter, it's not in a vacuum of biblical thought. In John chapter 1, you might recall that Jesus meets Peter. He says, Simon, son of John, or Simon Bar-Jonah, you shall be called Cephas, which is Peter. It depends on the language. Cephas is Aramaic. Peter is Greek. And of course, Simon, very Jewish, it would be the Hebrew name given to him. But the point is, there was a prophecy made about Peter. You are going to be called Rock. That's what he says in John 1, 42 and following. You're going to be called Rock. But it's not at that point that he's called that until this moment when he says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Peter says that. Jesus replies, Simon, son of John, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who's in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter. And on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. I'm going to call you a piece of the rock and this rock. Petros and Petra. Obviously, they sound a lot the same, but they are different words. I will build my church on this Petra. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. And he strictly charged the disciples not to tell anybody that he was the Christ. Right now is not the time. So that's the context immediately before verses 21 through 23, as I have here before you. And so what does he say? We read that from that time, Jesus began to show the disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. So at this moment of declaration, you are the Son of God. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus says, y'all don't need to tell anybody about this, but from this time on, he began showing them not only these things about his suffering, but that he would actually be killed and raised. I know they don't get it because when he dies, they think all hope's lost. So Peter, notice Peter. Peter, who just a paragraph before says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Peter took him aside. And you know what that means. When you take somebody aside, you're getting ready to tell them something that you think's really important. You're going to, you know, tell them something you think they need to know that maybe they don't know without you telling them. Or you're going to educate them on something they may not know. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Can you imagine anyone thinking, I'm going to rebuke the Christ, the Son of the living God? But here's Peter. But the rebuke is, far be it from you. You're not going to suffer. You're not going to die. Not on my watch. I mean, Peter, the very night that Jesus is betrayed, takes a sword and tries to knock the head off of Malchus, the high priest's servant's head. Instead, he gets an ear. And Jesus heals him before everybody, and they still arrest him. It's just an amazing story here. But Peter is like, it's not going to happen. Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you. Notice Peter doesn't say, not on my watch here in this context. He just says, this is never going to happen. And he turned and he said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. I've been called a lot of things. We've all had names thrown at us. I don't know that any of us has been called Satan and by the Lord himself. The name just means adversary or someone standing in the way. But still, we read, and this is exactly what it is in the Greek, get behind me, Satan. You are an hindrance to me. You're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. What? Get behind me, Satan. God has already revealed Jesus is going to suffer, be killed, and on the third day be raised. It's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. Get behind me, Satan. You're not setting your mind on the things of God. You're setting your mind on the things of men. Because that's how men think. That's just not going to happen. You're our leader. You're our master. It's not happening. You're not going to suffer. Not if I know you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, I'm going to do everything to defend you. We know the story with Peter, of course. He denies him three times before the cock crows. And so he claims he's willing to die for him, but can't even defend him in that first morning. But the notion here is that of setting one's mind. And in this context, Jesus tells Peter, you're setting your mind on things of man. You're looking at the priorities as men look at priorities, not as God. God sees things in a different way. Isaiah tells us that his thoughts and his ways are not our thoughts and ways. His thoughts and his ways are much higher than ours. And we need to remind ourselves of that. In Isaiah 55, verses 6, 7, and 8, when he says that, that's how powerful it is, the difference in the distinction between ourselves and God. There is probably one of the shortest verses in all the Bible is Luke 17, 32. It's three words. I know when I was a kid, probably all, if you were raised in any sort of church setting, that you would give or be given the project of memorizing a verse. And if you were worth yourself at all, and I mean by that, you know, somebody says, look, you choose the verse. Everybody did John 17, right? Or John 11, 35, excuse me. The shortest verse, which is two words, Jesus wept. And everybody goes, I'm so proud. This is the second shortest. Remember Lot's wife. Remember Lot's wife. Let's look at Luke 17 in this context surrounding verse 32. What Jesus says here. Because it's a reminder, just those three words are a reminder, don't do what she did, which is, and we know the story, People who don't even know the Bible know the story of what she did in looking back. She was told not to. She was told, as Lot and his whole family, you get out, you go, do not turn around. You're going to hear things. They aren't told they're going to smell things, but you can imagine sulfur coming out. I mean, we all know what that is. And all I'm saying is there was more to it than just the noise being made, but they were told don't turn around. So verse 32, let's start in verse 22. He said to the disciples, the days are coming when you'll desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man and you won't see it. And they're going to say to you, look there or look here. Don't go out or follow them. He's talking about the time when the Jerusalem itself is going to be destroyed. He says in verse 24, as the lightning flashes and lights up the sky from one side to the other, so will the Son of Man be in his day. It's going to happen very quickly. First, he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. Just as it was in the days of Noah, it'll be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating and drinking and marrying and being given in marriage till the day when Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them. In other words, they didn't see it coming. They knew it was coming because Noah preached it, but they didn't know, hey, today's the day. Likewise, verse 28, just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But on the day when Lot went out from Sodom, fire and sulfur rained from heaven and destroyed them all. So it will be on the day when the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, let the one who's on the housetop with his goods in the house not come down to get them. Likewise, let the one who's in the field not turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to preserve his life is going to lose it. Whoever loses his life will keep it. I tell you, in that night, there will be two in one bed. One will be taken, the other left. There will be two women grinding together. One will be taken, the other left. And they said, where? And he said, where the corpse is, that's where the vultures are going to gather. It depends on the translation. If it's not the corpses, it has something to do with the dead. And instead of vultures, eagles, which eagles are vultures. But the point is, eagles almost always represent Rome. And that's really what's going on here. Where the corpse is, the eagle is going to be flying. And the vulture, if you will, is going to be. And this is a whole entirely different lesson. But this is about the destruction of Jerusalem. But Jesus tells them, remember Lot's wife. Don't look back. Paul says, keep seeking the things above. If you've been raised with Christ, then keep seeking things above. Don't turn around and don't dwell on things here on earth. The priority isn't here. The priority is heaven. I came across this statement recently. Most have chosen heaven over hell. Fewer have chosen heaven over earth. Now that's one of those statements you read and you're kind of like, wait a second, I'm going to reread that one. Because I think it's right. There are a lot of folks who have chosen heaven over hell. They don't want to go to hell. Heaven is what they want. But when it comes to choosing heaven or earth, they've chosen the temporal things of the earth as more important and what we focus on than the things of heaven. Again, Paul said in Colossians 3, you seek those things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of the throne of God. That's what we need to be focusing on. All the troubles and all the trials of life, and yeah, they can get us down. It's not that they're not going to get us down. It's not that we're invulnerable and we won't get down. You think of David. How many years did he run from Saul? It didn't happen over a couple months. It was years of his life running from Saul before he ever became a recognized king. And do you know, for the 7 years that he ruled outside of Jerusalem in a totally different town, sorry, the name just totally evaded me, starts with an H, but that's all I got. It's one of those, you'll remember later, but all I was going to say is that when David was reigning those first 7 years, King Saul's family was trying to depose David and put one of their own up on the throne. It's not till 7 years after everybody's pretty much gone except one or two that David finally is able to rule in Jerusalem. And the road that he took, you think of his road, you think of Joseph. Joseph didn't become second in command overnight. You know, he's 17 years old and then he's around 40. It was 23 years of trial and travail and trouble before he gets to the point that he's number two in all the land. I'm an impatient person, and I know that I am. I want things that are broken to be fixed pretty quickly. I'm the sort of person, if it gets broken, whatever it is, I want immediately to have things going, rolling in the direction of we're getting this fixed, whatever it is. I like problems fixed. And I know sometimes, and I've learned this the hard way, I say I've learned it, I'm learning this, it's not a learned thing. Sometimes you just got to let it go for a little bit and then get to it. It takes a little time. I'm saying that to me more than you. It's hard sometimes, but there are so many who claim to follow Jesus who are enamored with earth and concerned over priorities that are earthly priorities. What were you worrying about a year ago from today, August the 16th, 2019? You probably have to think about it. If you have maybe some sort of a calendar on your phone, maybe even one of those desk calendars you write things in, you could probably go figure this thing out after a while. Go, oh, yeah, maybe I was worried about this or that. But I doubt very many of us would be right now thinking, what in the world was I worried about a year ago today? I can't tell you. And it's just not short-term memory. It's just after a year, moved on. That wasn't my priority now. Maybe I'll remember things a year from now, what's going on now. 2020's been a very unusual year for everybody. Let's be mindful of heaven over earth. What does 1 John 2 tell us? Let's look over at 1 John 2, 15 through 17. And in this context, John is urging us, just as he did in the first century, through the providence of God, through the direction of the Holy Spirit, as John was moved to write these words, he warns us not to love the world or the things in the world. He doesn't say don't like these things. He says don't love them. Love elevates. And he says do not elevate the world or the things that are in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father isn't in him. You remember Jesus in Matthew 6 made that very clear. You can't serve two masters. You're either going to love one and hate the other or despise one and hold to the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And yet we want to try. You know, maybe somebody else can't do that, but I can try. We can't look at two different things at the same time. It's like these flowers up here. You can't look at both of them at the same time if you're able to see them. You can see and focus on one, and you might say, well, in my slight peripheral, I can see them both. But to see them and focus at the same time, you can't do it. I mean, maybe if you're far enough back. I see Lori kind of cocking her head there. I can't. You know, I could stand right there. I'd have to turn my head to the one or the other. And maybe that's not the best illustration of the whole wide world. Probably not. But we can't focus on two things at one time. We can't serve God and mammon. And here he tells us, the love of the Father is not in the one who loves the world. All that's in the world, and he says what it is, desires of the flesh, desires of the eyes, and the pride of life. The New American Standard Bible says the sinful pride of life. Because there's a difference in being proud of something in the right way and being proud of something because, well, you're full of yourself. And that's the idea here of the sinful pride of life. These are not things that come from the Father. They're from the world. And the world is passing away. Let's read that again, verse 17. The world is passing away, along with its desires, which would be the desires of the flesh, eyes, and pride of life. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. I want to close with a passage here in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians 4, we'll look at verse 16 and move on through chapter 5, verse 11. Again, 2 Corinthians chapter 4, the last few verses here. Sometimes these verses are kind of saved up for a funeral, where we're trying to remind ourselves that this one whom we love has died and they've gone on into eternity. We want to remind ourselves of these things. We need to remind ourselves now while we're living to seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of the throne of God, like Paul says in Colossians 3, 1 and 2. Paul says here, we don't lose heart. We don't faint. We don't give up. Even though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. The things that are seen are temporal. The things that are unseen are eternal. For we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God. You notice the contrast. We have a tent, and if the tent is destroyed, and by the way, when they are speaking of tents in this time, I know almost always I think of a tent, either like a pup tent, you know, a little one-person tent, maybe two people fit into it. One of the biggest ones I've ever been to or been in, when we lived up in North Carolina, we go to the Outer Banks. The men from the church would basically get together. We go fishing. It was real fun and all, except a couple times where it froze at night, and I really hated that. But I remember we had like tents where 10 guys could fit in. That's kind of what we're talking about. It's really big because it was their house. I mean, this is what they lived in. And Paul is saying, as a tent maker, a tent repairer, we talked about that somewhat recently in our studies, we know that if that tent, that is our earthly home, is destroyed, we have a building from God. It's not that we have some other tent that'll be a little stronger. He says we have a building that's from God, a house that's not made with hands. It's eternal in the heavens. I think this is why God is telling us not to dwell on these earthly things. In this tent we groan, being longing to put on our heavenly dwelling. If indeed by putting it on, we may not be found naked or unclothed. While we're still in this tent, we groan being burdened. Not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed or clothed upon. The idea isn't just that we be a soulless body. Or let me put it back, it's the opposite. A bodiless soul. There's a big difference. It's not that. He says that we would be clothed upon, further clothed, that, as he says, mortality would be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who's given us the Spirit as a guarantee of it. And so what? We're always of good courage. That doesn't mean we always have a smile on our face, that no matter what, we're happy. That's not what he's saying here. We're always of good courage. We know that while we're at home in the body, we know, that's the confidence he speaks with, that as we're at home in the body, we're away from the Lord. We walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we'd rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we're at home or away, we're making it our aim. We're making it our goal. Our focus is to please Him. Why? For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what's due for what he's done in the body, whether good or evil. Therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, we talked some this morning of the right kind of fear. This is the right kind of fear. Knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade others. But what we are is known to God, and I hope it's known to you also, he says, and he goes on talking in that direction. But I want us to understand, everyone's going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. If we are faithful to Him, we've done our utmost to serve Him in accordance with His revealed will, when you stand before the judge, you're not going to be afraid. I'm not saying there's not any fear at all, but if you've done the right thing, you stand before even a human judge. You stand there with confidence. Here, using that legal idea, we have as our defender, Jesus. In 1 John 2, he says, if we sin, we have an advocate with the Father. You think of it in this way. We have Jesus, who not only serves as judge in 2 Corinthians 5:10, but he's our advocate, and he is defending us. We've got to set our minds on things above. What that looks like is what we were reading about in Colossians chapter 3 there, of how we're to put off, kill this part of our body, and put on. It may be we say, well, we have put these things off. We're not doing those things anymore. Well, what are we putting on? What's the positive? It's not just that you stop doing, it's what you start doing. And so we want to be mindful of those things above, and primarily because it's where Christ is. He's not here. He's not coming back to earth to live here on earth. The Bible doesn't reveal that. 1 Thessalonians 4 tells us He's going to come and receive us to Himself, that where He is, we'll be also. Where's that? He says in the clouds. We'll meet the Lord in the air, and that's how we'll always be with Him. He's not coming back to set a foot here on earth. We need to be ready, though, because we don't know when it's going to come. The Bible makes it clear that day is coming. We just don't know when it is. You can't look on your calendar and go, well, we've got 30 days. We've got 60 days. We've got 10 years. It could be today. And I'll tell you honestly, there are some days I'm like, man, I wish it was today. There are other days, quite honestly, I think if he puts it off till tomorrow, that would be fine. But I want us to have that attitude that Paul himself has. Set your mind on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. If you've been raised with Christ, then keep seeking those things. The song we're going to sing here is a song of encouragement. What will your answer be? Everyone's going to stand before God in judgment. What is our answer going to be? If you need to be baptized, let's do that, because God commands it. That's all that we need is God's command, not what men think, not even know how many men think a certain thing. It's what does God say? What does He think? He's going to judge us. If we've lived that way, we've been baptized, been born again of water and spirit, but we're not living the way we know we should, this is a time, if we need that, for the prayers of our brothers and sisters. Come forward as we stand and sing together.